It's time for another episode of One Test Wonders and the stories of players who were picked to play for their country just once. This time we talk with opening batsman Andy Lloyd. Andy had an excellent career, latterly as Warwickshire captain, and scored more than 17,000 first-class runs. But perhaps he's best known for his one test appearance against the mighty West Indies side of 1984, and how it ended prematurely for him because of a horrendous incident after just half an hour's play. The story of that incident takes up a great deal of this podcast, as you'd expect. But as Andy and I chatted, we also put his test call-up into context, and we discussed how he rebuilt his career at first-class level, all the while knowing he could never play for England again. Let's get cracking with a fascinating story. Andy, you made your test appearance in 1984, but do you actually think you should have been given the chance the previous summer or on the winter tours of New Zealand and Pakistan? Because, of course, in 1983... you scored, I think it was over 1,600 first-class runs with 500s, and it was the fourth time in a row you'd actually topped 1,400 first-class runs in a season. Should you have had a chance a bit earlier, do you think?
I don't think that it was unjust. I think one of the complicating factors was obviously the captain of England at that time was yours and my great friend, sadly lost to us now, Bob Willis. And obviously, throughout my early stages of my career, my development completely, he was at very close quarters with me and obviously knew my attributes and also knew a lot about my failings. And he kept saying to me, just runs, get you into the England setup. And, you know, and I, as you say, for a couple of years, I got a lot of runs. But by the same token, I think the people that were around at that time trying to get that top order spot or spots were also scoring plenty of runs. I mean, I think Tav was scoring stacks for Kent. Chris Smith, obviously, was just coming over from South Africa, and he was scoring 100 after 100. And Graham Fowler, you know, he was my contemporary. We played England schools together. He'd sort of got the spot, and he was playing really well too. So, you know, it was a very competitive situation. So to say I should have played earlier, I think it would have been nice. I was called up in 83 at Lord's for the match against New Zealand, and I was 12th man. Bob was captain again. I think they just put Chris Tavray up to open the batting that day, which meant I didn't get the chance to play. But still, I got a good taste of the environment, what it was like to be around a test match dressing room, and it was a good experience. Whether I should have played or not is another matter, but you know, I got the chance the following year.
Well, before your test, of course, you were called up for the one-day international series against the West Indies. There were three matches at Old Trafford, Trent Bridge, Lord's. Did you know you were in the selectors' thoughts then? I think you'd played for the MCC against Essex, hadn't you, in the traditional season opener?
Yeah, that tour of New Zealand and Pakistan in 1983 and early 84 was a pretty moderate tour on the field for England. And clearly, there were going to be a few changes made. David Gower was made captain. And I knew that I had to get myself in, I was in Australia at the time, good state of fitness, practice hard, so that when I went back to England for the early part of the season in England, I was on top of my game. And as you say, I got to play in that opening, the Champion County, we played Essex. And at that time, Gucci was banned from international cricket, I think, because of his South African tours. And he was great, obviously, a great player, Graham, and a good man. And Essex were a very strong side. And I remember in the first innings, I got to 20 and I nicked one from Neil Foster straight to Graham at second slip, knee height, straight in, and he dropped it. And, you know, we all need luck in our careers to progress. And Cork, Gooch, Bull, Foster, 20, was that good enough to get into the England setup? Maybe not, but he dropped it and I went on and scored 100. And, you know, that was good enough to get, you would think, to, you know, give me a good shout for getting into the England side. And the following game, I went and we went back to Warwickshire, and I think that was against Northampton, and I got 100 in that match. And I thought then, you know, I couldn't really do much more to put my cap in the ring.
Do you remember how you found out you'd been selected for the one-day international squad? I think you were playing a county championship match against Worcestershire at Edgbaston. Was it the traditional way back then of tuning in on the radio at midday or via a club announcement over the PA system?
That's right. It was we were just listening on the radio and my name was read out, and that was great fun. And, you know, the one-day games were probably, you know, not that they weren't my forte, if you like. I've always put myself as a better long game player than a short game player. But of course, in those days, there were 55 over matches, so they did need a good steady start. You know, I mean, it's completely changed, obviously, to the way the game is played now. But I was keen. I was well up for it. And we went to Old Trafford for the first one, I think. And I was on the outfield with Graham Fowler, who, as I say, was a good pal, having played with him in schools cricket. And he said, "What do you want to do? Take the first ball, or would, do you want to just wait and I'll have the first ball?" And I said, no, you have the first ball. You're number one. I'll wait. And I just sort of get myself attuned to the atmosphere. And he said, "Well, should we bat first or should we be bowling first? What do you want?" I said, "I don't really care." And West Indies batted first, and obviously we came and chased a very big total.
What was it like to be on the field on your debut there with Viv Richards scoring that then record-breaking 189 not out? That must have been, a baptism of fire, to say the least.
It was absolutely awesome. I mean, it was a lovely day. It was a good pitch. And the detail of that game is really quite extraordinary. At lunchtime, I think the West Indies were 103 for 7. And Viv was, I think, 51 not out. And he was batting with Eldine Baptiste, I think. And we came in at lunchtime. And obviously, we were in a fantastic place. You know, what a start to the summer. The thing had gone absolutely superbly. And then after lunch, we went out. I think there were about 17, 18 overs to go. And as you say, Viv ended, I mean, just smashed it all over the park. I mean, it was just ridiculous how well he played. And of course, he had the support from the other end with Eldine, and I think Mikey got a few. And, you know, they ended up with a massive total. And Viv, 189, was a number that stood as a record for a long time.
So you lost that series 2-1. You made 15, 49 and 37. How did you feel you acquitted yourself? Was international cricket as you expected it to be?
Yeah, it was pretty tough. I mean, these guys, obviously the West Indians at that time had arguably never been a better fast bowling attack set foot on a cricket field than the one they had at the time. And I think, you know, you mentioned those numbers, and I think I scored more runs than any other England batsman in that series. So I felt, even though we'd lost, that I'd sort of done reasonably well, even though perhaps when I got the 37 and the 49, like any proper batsman, you go in thinking you should have gone on and got more. But like I say, these guys were a very, very strong outfit to bat against, and you were never, ever taking it easy. You could never cruise against the West Indies. You know, I think they had Roger Harper, who was the token slow bowler, but he was a brilliant fielder. And you know, one of the team talks, I remember Lords, you know, we said, "Look, don't run anywhere near because he'll just run you out." And he got Lammy out exactly doing that. They're an amazing side.
How helpful was it for you to find your feet in one day international cricket before being thrown into Test cricket? Because obviously you got the chance to be around the England one day squad. How many of those did you actually know? Were you able to feel welcome there?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't a raw youngster here in county terms. You know, I was in my late 20s and I played against a lot of the West Indian guys, never mind the England side. And yeah, I knew most of the fellas that were playing and I was playing with, and they made me feel very welcome. David was a new captain, and you know, it was a very nice atmosphere. I think we were all very conscious of the task that we were all facing, but nevertheless, from a personal angle, you know, I couldn't have wished for any better welcome to the dressing room, to be honest.
And the Warwickshire dressing room, of course, which you came out of, was full of experienced heads at the time, players who'd played international or top-level cricket, Alvin Kalicharan, Dennis Amiss, Bob Willis himself, Chris Old, Norman Gifford, Jeff Humpage, Anton Ferreira, the list goes on. How helpful were any of those or others to you in this period? Did you have a particular mentor you went to?
I tried to pick everybody's brains, really. Dennis Amiss and Alvin Kalajdzic were the two people that basically helped me most all through my early career. Dennis was number one, I was number two, Alvin was number three. And as a young kid trying to make his way in the game, to have two players of that quality around you was just incredibly lucky, you know, because if we were chasing in a county game, if we were chasing a total, Alvin was, once he got in, he said, just give me the strike, I'll hit the fours, you just keep knocking it around, taking the pressure off you. Now, Dennis would say, look, this guy's bowling really well here, leave as much as you can and just wait till his spell's finished. And then we'll look to move forward late to, you know, in half an hour's time. They were fascinating people to talk to about batting. The other guy, I mean, there was David Brown was our manager. Obviously, as you say, Norman Gifford and Bob, huge experience. And they basically gave me the atmosphere of what it was all, what was required. And I was ready to play. I was ready to play.
Well, for your selection in the Test squad, after your performance in the one-day international team, did you think it was a foregone conclusion or were you still a little bit nervous?
I mean, not nervous. I mean, I think it would have been very, very hard on me had I not been picked for that Test match, having, as I say, done the early bit in the season at Lord's, and my form in the early season was good. I'd done reasonably well in the one-day internationals, and I think it would have been hard not to have been picked. And you spoke earlier about how I got to hear of the one-day selection, that the Test match selection, everybody kind of expected it. But that weekend, we were playing Essex in Ilford. And often when we went down there to play against Cambridge University or Essex, a few of us would go down. We were all interested in horse racing, so we'd go down to Newmarket and perhaps stay overnight. And that morning, on the Sunday morning before that Test match, we were staying with a chap called Gavin Pritchard-Gordon. And it was in his kitchen at 11 o'clock when out they come, Lamb, Lloyd, and then the champagne court went, and, you know, we had a glass of champagne before we went off to Ilford.
Magnificent. So, well, that game finished, of course, on the Tuesday evening before the Test match, and you'd actually lost that championship match against Essex. Then, presumably, you headed back north to Birmingham for the build-up, which in those days amounted to, well, just one day of light practice and a get-together. Was it the build-up for the Test busy for you, especially given it was your home ground?
I mean, we had a little practice. I was in very familiar circumstances, obviously, changing in my own seat. I didn't stay at the team hotel. I went back to my house after we had dinner the evening before the Test match. The boys were staying in the Plough and Harrow, which I could have stayed in, but I chose to go and just sleep in my own bed. And I was relaxed and as sort of prepared as I could be. Obviously, you're nervous. You know, if you don't have nerves, you aren't treating any event like that in the correct way. I think you need to be nervous but confident that you can cope with what's ahead of you. And I think I was in a very good place. I was in a very good place at that time, yeah.
Was there much chat during that team dinner about the bowlers you'd face? I guess everyone knew all those bowlers because they'd all played county cricket, of course.
Yeah, I think chat is you know, you couldn't say chat. I mean, the team dinner was not really that detailed. I mean, Peter May was chairman of selectors. He got up and introduced David. He'd been around for several years before being appointed, obviously, and all the boys knew him. So there was a bit of Mickey taking going on when he was starting his team talk. But I think basically we were all just getting together, you know, wishing each other luck and trying to find ways of getting out their batting lineup, which was obviously very strong as well, obviously with the bowlers as well. You know, they were a good team.
Did you have a net beforehand, either on the day before the Test or on the morning of the match? I mean, did you have a pre-match routine that you followed?
I wasn't big on nets on the morning of a game. I don't think I had a net on the morning of the game. I had a lot of throwdowns. I like throwdowns and just feeling the ball in the middle of the bat and sort of keeping the confidence levels up. I always think if you go in a net and it doesn't go well on the morning of a game, different on the Wednesday. I did have a net on the Wednesday, but on the morning of most matches, I didn't always go into the nets. Dennis Amos went every single morning, so that was not following his sort of preaching. But I just felt it was important to feel the ball in the middle of the bat, play a few off the back foot, a few off the front foot, and, you know, just get yourself mentally ready more than anything else on the morning.
Do you remember that on that first morning, Bob Willis actually announced he'd be retiring from cricket at the end of the season, with the news coming out on that first day? If so, Was it emotional for you, given your connection together through the whole of your Warwickshire career?
I kind of knew that was coming, to be honest with you. You know, Bob had always been a very good and close friend of mine throughout my time at Warwickshire. And, you know, he had his captaincy of England. He sort of, I think he felt that he'd achieved as much as he could achieve. And I know his body, you know, he's a big chap, as we all know, with a high knee action. He'd had multiple injuries through his career. And I think he felt that, you know, it was getting near time to call it a day. And he was one of the great England fast bowlers. His record tells you that. But to be honest, on that morning, I wasn't thinking much about Bob Willis. I was thinking more about Micah Holding, Malcolm Marshall, and, you know, the guys I was facing that morning.
Did you actually have any advice for David Gower about the pitch? Obviously, it's your home ground. Did he ask for advice or advice from Bob, maybe?
I'm sure he would have spoken with Bob. I think Bob, I mean, I knew that Edgbaston pitch very well, and they all said it was a good batting pitch. But at that time, it had a little bit of uneven bounce in it. And the one thing that you had to do, I think, was really play as straight as you could, because the pitch is easy paced, not a quick pitch, but the uneven bounce was why Bob liked bowling there. It didn't necessarily do too much off the seam, extravagantly anyway, but the uneven bounce, you know, LBWs and bowls were the way to get people out at Edgbaston.
Were England actually forced to bat first, you think, after winning the toss because of the inclusion of both spinners, Jeff Miller and Nick Cook?
I found that, and I still to this day find that, an incredible selection. You know, like I say, uneven bounce was the thing. And Neil Foster was made 12th man, I think. And I couldn't believe they played both spinners. I mean, Nick Cook, I think, would have been the one to be left out. I'm guessing, I don't know, because obviously Jeff was a bit stronger with the bat, or a lot stronger with the bat than Nick. But I was amazed at that selection. And I remember thinking that at the time, you know, wow, you know, surely the seamers are going to win this game. If we're going to win it, you know, it would be the people bowling seam up. And if you look back at the test matches historically at Edgbaston, and even today, the spinner tends to have a holding role. If things aren't going well, it's actually the seamers that win the matches. And I think it's the same today, you know, X years later. You know, but at that time, I was amazed that both spinners were picked. I thought it was a big error.
Were you happy to bat first in the conditions that were presented, or would you have liked to have bowled first to get into the match that way?
No. I was very happy to bat first. I think if you're going to win the game again, if you're trying to win the game at Edgbaston, you've got to get a number on the board. In those days, if you got 250 on the board at Edgbaston and you bowl well, you were in the game. And I think, obviously, it didn't happen. History tells you that, you know, they just sort of blew us away. But the fact is, the only way we were going to win was by getting a good score on the board in the first innings, putting them under a bit of pressure with the bat and with the ball rather, and the seamers, you know, keeping it tight and bowling them out. That would have been the way to win that game. And the selection for me was flawed.
Were you a particularly nervous person ahead of a match or ahead of batting first? You mentioned you'd gone home and slept at home the night before the game. Had you managed to get a decent night's sleep?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I slept very well. I probably had a glass of wine or two, you know, but it was nothing extravagant. I wouldn't have drunk much at the team dinner. I might have gone back and had a glass at home, but I mean, nothing, obviously nothing untoward. And I slept well, yeah. Just got to the ground. It's just my normal routine, you know, for any Warwickshire game. Rocked up at the ground, parked in my usual spot, went to my usual seat and said hello to the boys that dressing room attendants, Taff and his guys, and it was just a normal day almost. It was actually very good for me and relaxing for somebody in my position at that time.
Did you have any family or friends who attended that day?
No, not really. My father had already passed away. My mother was in Shropshire, and she got very nervous, and she felt she was much better just watching from afar.
And Graham Fowler, you mentioned in the One Day Internationals, he took first strike. And he took first strike in the test match as well. Was that something you were comfortable with? Something you'd agreed on for that first test?
Yeah, obviously batting with Dennis Amos at Edgbaston. Dennis took the first ball when I was playing for Warwickshire. So I had, again, it was just business as usual on that front. I wasn't overly bothered about that at all. You know, I think, I'm pretty sure the first over was a maiden.
Malcolm Marshall bowled that first over, and it was a maiden to Graham Fowler. Do you remember your first ball in Test cricket then? It was in the second over from Joel Garner?
Yeah, I think I played and missed, didn't I? Have you seen the replays? I don't know. I think I probably played and missed at the first one.
I've seen video of your first run, which was you being opened up a little bit by Garner as he got the ball to seam away. You got a thickish outside edge into the covers.
That's right. And it just went past gully, wide of the covers right hand, and I said one. Yeah, and that was my first run in Test cricket. And that was the only time that we were in front in the series. So I think Foxy was out that over, wasn't he? He was caught down the leg side. Jeff Dujon took a brilliant catch. Was that right? Or maybe
yes.
Over too late?
Yes, you're right. It was. It all started to go downhill very quickly. And on that basis, I'm wondering what your initial impression of conditions was. Was there much swing or movement off the seam?
I don't recall there being that much swing. There was a little bit of movement off the deck. Obviously, these guys have got a new ball in their hand, and they're the two of the best new ball bowlers, you know, the game's ever seen. And, yeah, the ball moved around a bit. But, I mean, Graham's dismissal, there was nothing to do with the pitch. I mean, it was just a ball down the leg side. He gloved it, I think, down the leg side.
And Derek Randall chopped on to another vicious lifter from Joel, and you're leaning on your bat at the non-striker's end. It's 5-2, and you're thinking, oh, this is Test cricket then.
Well, yeah. Then I thought, wow, you know, this is not going to be easy. And then David walked in at number four, and I think I had the second over of Malcolm. I clipped one for four. And David, at the end of that over, he said, look, well done, Lloydie. You're looking really good. Just keep playing like this and we're going to be all right. I felt very comfortable in the environment. I wasn't nervous. I wasn't taking things for granted. I mean, this was the hardest task that I'd ever had to face as a batsman. But I was very confident that I was able to deal with it because I'd got my, like I say, back, push forward, leave it outside the off stump. I'd only got three or four balls that I was going to score off. And, you know, I knew that was my game and that was my game plan. And it was going pretty well. You know, clearly, these guys bowl good balls. And you miss a few. You know, but you've just got to put that back and they can only bowl them one at a time. Out comes the next one and you play it to the best of your ability. And I felt that I had been doing that and was relaxed. And as I said, David came down. He said, look, you're playing very well. Just keep doing all this and, you know, we'll move on. And, however long it was, 27 minutes or something, it was the first ball of the seventh over, I'm guessing. And it was a short ball that I was hoping initially, I played it to go over my left shoulder, to leave it and let it go over my shoulder. And then it just angled back at me slightly off the pitch. He always got in quite close to the wickets, Malcolm. And, you know, it was a straightish ball, but I thought it was going to just pass over my left shoulder. And it just came back at me. And I tried to corkscrew out of the way and, you know, it caught me, banged me.
Did you misread the length or was it just a ball that didn't get up?
I didn't misread the length. It's hit me on the head and, you know, I wasn't that low, I don't think, when it hit me. I was trying to sort of corkscrew out of the way rather than duck because I could see it coming for me and I tried to get my head back and out of the way. But I felt it just came back at me slightly off the pitch. It may have been my misjudgment. I can't say I analysed it that closely or ever have done.
Ahead of that, Clive Lloyd had made a field change. He'd brought Larry Gomes up into a sort of leg gully position from square leg. There were four slips and a gully, cover short leg, long leg. Were you aware maybe of that change and thinking, well, maybe Malcolm's going to drop one in short here?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you're not looking to get your big dog forward on the front foot against these guys. You know, I got my way that I was going to play, which is basically off the back foot and look to get my weight back into the balls that were pitched up. And yeah, I knew exactly where the fielders were. And I didn't think Larry Gomes was in the game for me because I didn't envisage doing anything other than sort of getting out of the way of the bouncers, the short ones. And then if they were not quite so short, obviously, like I said earlier on, playing straight at Edgbaston was crucial to your long-term survival. And that's what you had to do off the front and back foot. And look, I don't think that change of field made any difference at all to what I was doing. Nothing at all.
Did the ball that struck you actually hit you on the head directly, or did it hit the Perspex shield around your head and push that onto your temple?
I was wearing a very, it was like a prototype helmet that Dennis Amos had worn, basically one of Dennis's old helmets, and it had got little side pieces on. And look, I'm sure that they helped reduce the impact, but I'm sure, having carried on playing after I recovered, had I been wearing a helmet that they wear today, for example, I would have just got up and faced the next ball. You know, the helmets today are absolutely different class to the ones that I was using. Mine was like a tissue box compared to the ones that they use today. Yeah. But hey, you know, that's the way we were at that time.
Absolutely. Well, you went down, you stayed down. Jeff Dujon, Desmond Haynes, who was at short leg, Roger Harper from the slips, Barry Mayer, who was at square leg, the umpire, they were first on the scene. Did you actually lose consciousness? Do you remember anything that anyone was saying?
No, I didn't lose consciousness. Des was at short leg. I think he said, "Take it easy, man, take it easy, man," or something. You know, just I didn't lose consciousness. It was all happening quite quickly. And then I think Bernard Thomas came on with Neil Foster. And at that time, you know, there was no pain as such. You know, whether it's just nervous energy, adrenaline, whatever it was, I wasn't necessarily hurting from the blow. But then when Bernard came on, he said, "You're going to have to go off." And I said, "Oh, I'm not sure about that. Like, give me 2 minutes." And then I looked at one of the boundary signboards, which in those days, it was a TV company called Rediffusion. And I couldn't read Rediffusion clearly. And that's when I knew I got something wrong with my eye and I had to go off. That was when I knew, and that was me done.
You got up in quite sprightly fashion when you eventually got back to your feet. Were you aware of the swelling that had appeared on your right temple as well?
No, I wasn't. I mean, clearly at the time, I guess you're in a state of shock, and the adrenaline rush is just amazing, I'm guessing. I didn't really feel, as I say, hurt, pain as such. I didn't experience excruciating pain that I just needed, morphine or anything like that for. I mean, I remember walking off the field. I don't think I was staggering all over the place. You know, I was very, might have been a slow walk, but it was a steady one.
Watching the video back, you actually looked quite angry or at least frustrated. Was that your overriding emotion at that stage?
Yeah, I do recall that. Yeah, I was just annoyed that the ball had hit me, because short bowling is never, not afterwards, not before, short pitch bowling has never ever been something that I've had a problem with or have been fazed by. And look, I've been hit a few times, and I've not played it brilliantly every single time. But as a general rule, you know, short bowling is not something that's ever made me uncomfortable, and it's not easy to play. But you know, you have to deal with that, and I accept that. And the fact is, at the time, I was just very annoyed that all this had happened. You know, that, you know, I knew that I wasn't in great shape, and I was just annoyed that, you know, I hadn't been able to deal with things better.
Did David Gower or any of the West Indies players say anything to you out there before you left the field?
Not that I recall, no. The most of the time, obviously, Bernard Thomas, the England physio, was also the Warwickshire physio at that time. And I was talking with Bernard more than anybody else. I mean, I remember Bernard saying, "Right, come on, Andy, you know, we've got to get you into the dressing room." So, and like you say, I was a bit annoyed and with all that, but I knew that he was right, because he's a good man, Bernard. Sadly, he's not with us anymore, but you know, he was the one I was listening to. I'm sure some of the other people saying things that just didn't register.
These days, of course, there'd be all sorts of concussion tests and this, that, and the other. But when you were out on the field, was there even anything as rudimentary as that? Was Bernard just holding fingers up and saying, "How many fingers am I holding up," or anything like that?
Yeah, I don't recall that. As I say, when I looked at this boundary sign and my eyes were clearly something wrong with my vision, that's when I knew that I had to go off. I didn't feel, you know, that hurt, but clearly, the more you sort of stood up and came to your senses almost, you knew that there was a big problem here. And, you know, that's why, you know, Bernard, he was right most of the time, and he was then.
When you got back to the dressing room, what happened then? Was there a doctor on duty there to examine you?
Yeah, the doctor came in, and I would like to think that this all happened at about 11:30, and I would say not long after 12 o'clock, I would have been in the QE in the Queen Elizabeth Hospital.
Yes, there's actually footage on the TV highlights that I've seen of you before lunch being put into a car by Bernard Thomas and being driven away. Bernard was outside the car and obviously giving instructions to you and the driver, whoever it was who was driving the car, because it was out the back of the pavilion, of course, and one of the cameras on top of the pavilion had swung round and just captured the moment.
I know which camera you mean. It might have been Alan Oakman. Alan Oakman was the coach at Warwickshire at that time too. And I think Oakey might have taken me to the hospital.
Before you went to hospital, obviously you were in the dressing room. Did players come and check on your situation? Or as often happens in cricket dressing rooms, you know how things are, individuals try to stay away from a player who's injured just to try and maintain the focus on themselves.
Yeah, I think that was the case. I don't remember. I went straight into the medical room at the back of the dressing room in those days, and I don't remember any of the other lads coming in. I mean, there was obviously a lot happening out on the field.
Did you go into shock in the dressing room or later once the adrenaline had subsided?
Well, if you say going into shock, I mean, when I got into hospital, I had initial tests and they told me that I just got to stay still. I think I went to sleep. By about 2 o'clock, I was probably asleep. And whether that was because of the pills they'd given me or for reduce the pain or the swelling, I don't know. But I think I certainly had an afternoon nap.
Once you'd been examined, there was obviously a decision to keep you in. If so, how resistant to that idea were you? Or had you by that stage just resigned yourself to going with the flow?
Yeah, no, I wasn't resistant at all to that. I knew that I'd got a problem with my right eye. All you had to do was shut your left eye and then you couldn't hardly see anything out of your right eye. So you knew there was something wrong. So there was never any objection on my part to any. Once I was in the hospital, I knew I was in the place that I had to be, and the people looked after me brilliantly.
What was the treatment? Was it a darkened room, no TV, that sort of thing?
Luckily, at that time in Birmingham, there was an eye specialist called Professor James Cruz, and I remember seeing him that afternoon, and he said, "Oh yeah, this is it's not good." The back of your eye is made up of a series of cones and rods, which basically transmit the light images back to your brain. And some of these cones and rods had been destroyed and others were damaged. And the only way of getting these things right was by basically staying as still as possible, resting. Don't bend down to tie up your shoelaces or things like that. It was just to keep your head upright and as still as possible for most of the time. So, it was just a very, very difficult thing that I had to come to terms with there and then. I knew then it wasn't going to get better quickly.
So that was the point at which it started to become apparent to you that this wasn't going to just be a straightforward injury recovery, that this was a very serious injury.
Yeah. I knew that on certainly the day after when the professor came in and gave me a bigger check. He said, "This will take time." He said, "And I cannot guarantee or tell you what level of recovery your eye is going to make." I stayed in hospital for a week, I think, 6 days or something, before they let me out.
Gosh, that must have been a hammer blow to hear that as a professional sportsman.
Well, in cricket, obviously, your eyesight is absolutely key. If you don't have great eyesight, you can't be a top batsman anyway. It was a very difficult thing to come to terms with over the next 3 to 18 months, because we got to the Benson Hedges Cup final and we were playing Lancashire in the final of the Bensons. And I was really keen to play, which is about sort of 6 weeks after this, I think, or a month after. And I tried to make a feeble effort to prove to Bob and David Brown and Dennis that I was fit. But I mean, I clearly wasn't. So that became a bit of a non-entity. And I went down to Lourdes with the Warwickshire squad. And strangely enough, Clive Lloyd went down with the Lancashire squad. He wasn't playing either, of course. We all stayed in the same hotel. I think it was called the Westmoreland in those days. You might remember that. And we went out, my wife and I went out on the Saturday night, and we left our little girl, Georgia, in the hotel room. But they had a babysitting arrangement where it was, you know, she was checked on every 20 minutes or something. Anyway, we get back in at about 11 o'clock, and the little girl's absolutely bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And Georgie, why aren't you asleep? She said, the phone has just not stopped ringing. These people keep ringing up to speak to Clive Lloyd. And I keep telling them that this is not Clive Lloyd's room. It's Andy Lloyd's room. And when the third time this happened, she said, I did describe to them that Clive Lloyd was the big black one and Andy Lloyd was the little pink one. Can you please get it right? And it was very funny. It was just one of those things. And
at least you had something to put a smile on your face in that case.
Oh, then. No, it was very funny. It was. We laughed and laughed about that. Yeah, it was very funny.
What about family and friends, though, while you were in hospital in Birmingham, and indeed teammates? Was anyone allowed to come and visit you?
Not initially. I remember Pat Murphy from Radio 5 Live.
It'd be Radio 2 in those days, I suppose.
Radio 2 was it in those days, yeah. He came in with a friend of mine who worked at the hospital. He wangled his way in. And, he came and had a chat. He was a friend, Pat. And, I basically had a quick chat with him, but that was all. But, various people came along and wished me all the best. The people from Warwickshire came, and after the test match, Clive spoke to me on the telephone, and nobody likes seeing what happened to me. Nobody in cricket enjoys it, but at the end of the day, I've always looked upon it. It's part of the game, and I was on the wrong end of it for once.
Well, you wore a chest guard that was visible under your sweater when you batted, an arm guard of foam on your right forearm, and that helmet without a visor.
Yeah.
Had you ever worn a visor before?
No, never worn a visor. I mean, basically, the other protection, I mean, you knew they were going to ball a lot of short balls at you. And obviously, if you get hit in the ribs or on the forearm, I mean, it's very, very painful. And the protective gear that I wore then in those areas didn't affect me at all. It didn't affect your movement or my batting or anything. I was very comfortable wearing all that stuff. I just never, ever, up until later, wore a bars or a face guard.
Well, there were a few types of helmets around in those days, weren't there? There were the ones that you wore, obviously, the ones without the visor on. Then there was the one with the Perspex visor that a few people used. And there was also one with a sort of man in the iron mask type grill on it as well. I know Derek Pringle and Nick Cook used that one. Had you experimented with any of those, or you just simply stuck to that one that Dennis Amos had given you?
I'd stuck to it. I'd not got hit on the head previously. I always was very confident of managing with the short pitch bowling. And I suppose you could say, was I arrogant? Was I overconfident in not wearing a better helmet? And, clearly hindsight tells you everything, doesn't it? In hindsight, I'd have worn the best possible helmet. But at the time, that was the one that I was comfortable in. I was confident that I wasn't going to get hit. And, sadly, it didn't work out that way.
You're obviously hit on the head. You mentioned that it was the first time you'd been struck. Just put it into context for us, Andy, about those days, because virtually every county had a seriously quick bowler in their ranks, didn't they? Because most international players made their livings in the summers ahead of playing during the winter for their respective countries by playing county cricket, didn't they?
They did, And they were absolutely top-class bowlers. I mean, the previous year, in 1983, before the test match at Lord's where I was called up into the 12 against New Zealand, I played at the Oval against Sylvester Clark. Now, in those days, the Oval was a quick and bouncy track prepared for Sylvester. And he was a nasty bowler. Probably not as good a bowler strategically as the others, Holding and Garner and Marshall, etc. But he was as quick and certainly probably more aggressive. And in that game at the Oval, I carried my bat in the Warwickshire innings on the Saturday. I'll never forget that in the Sunday Telegraph the following day, and I'm not one for media papers much at all. It's easy come, easy go. But Mihir Bose, who's a much respected writer at the time, had said that Andy Lloyd carried his bat for 123, but unfortunately, didn't ever look comfortable and wouldn't have done much to enhance his test match prospects. And said, on the Tuesday evening, Bob said to me, they want you to get to Lord's for the test match on Thursday, go down to third man and start thinking about it. You know, Clarkey was a very, very lethal fast bowler. You know, he was a top draw quick. He wasn't as good a bowler, Marcus. He didn't have the seam movement or the swing or the probably the subtlety of the three that I mentioned earlier. But boy, he could let it go, I can tell you.
Were Marshall and Garner a different proposition playing for the West Indies than when they were playing county cricket?
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, you only play them. Well, we played Somerset twice a year at the time. So we were always coming up against Viv and Joel on the county circuit. But Joel, he wouldn't have been as focused in his county spells. He certainly bowled with much more purpose and pace in the one-day games and the test match than he ever did against me in county cricket. I'm Malcolm the same too. You know, I mean, we only played Hampshire once a year. But, you know, obviously I played against him previously. And, you know, these guys, it was a long season, as you said rightly. In those days, every county had terrific overseas players and a lot of them were fast bowlers. And when I was captain after all this, I mean, we had Alan Donald. And I think all the people that we mentioned, the difference between them and Alan Donald was Alan Donald just tried and tried every single day for Warwickshire. He was an amazing overseas player. Whereas I think, I'm not saying Malcolm and Joel Garner and Clarkey and all the others, Andy Roberts, Michael Holden, you know, they were great bowlers. But, you know, I think sometimes they would try and manage their own workload at the time.
Fair enough, too. Now, obviously, after you'd been struck, you went to hospital. How quickly were you able to get your head around not only missing the rest of the test, but also the matches that followed? And when did you find out your season was over?
I found out my season was over about a month afterwards when I went to try and get playing in that Benson Hedges final. I knew when I left the hospital after a week that it wasn't ever going to be the same. Because some of these cones and rods had been killed forever. And it was just a question of how quickly the rest of the eye could recover and how much it would have affected my vision. And I knew after about 3 weeks, I was really struggling to play again that season.
I've heard you quoted as saying that the vision in your right eye was reduced by 35%. How much of a handicap was that to start playing again, especially, of course, as your right eye was your leading eye, the one nearest the bowler?
I was never as sharp again. You know, I was never as good again. The first time I played cricket properly was on a tour to Zimbabwe. I went with a Midland Counties tour. Martin Nicholas captained it. There was Paul Terry, and I think Nick Cook was on it, and Chippy Williams. And it was a great bunch of guys. Neil Williams, I think. And what I found most trouble to start with was fielding, because judging the distance of the ball was coming at me a lot quicker than, and I was dropping. My fielding was never brilliant, but I mean, it was terrible after I'd got hit on the head. I had to be very careful where I put myself so I wasn't too busy in catching terms. I was all right at stopping it and running and throwing, but catching and judging depth of the ball was very tricky. And when I was batting, judging the depth is very easy when the ball hits the surface. So whenever they bowled short, it was easy because the ball was bouncing halfway down. The balls that I had most trouble with were Yorkers. And there was a chap at Lancashire called David Makinson who got me out three times, bowled twice and LBW once by bowling Yorkers. He hit me on the boot and bowled me with Yorkers two other times because I was struggling to pick up the length. And that slowly came back. Probably 18 months later, I was near the end of the following season, I was just playing a bit better then, and I was more comfortable. But it was the fielding to start was the worst bit. The fielding, catching was shocking.
You mentioned you went on that English Counties tour to Zimbabwe in 84-5. And ironically, of course, you opened the batting with Paul Terry because he'd had his test career ended in that same West Indies series after his left arm was broken by Winston Davis. Did you ever compare notes?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, Paul, we became very good friends, actually, because Paul was the most brilliant fielder. He was an absolutely fantastic fielder. And of course, he would try and help me with fielding drills to get me better at the catching. So, and obviously, we compared notes with the fast bowling injuries and stuff. Greg Chapwell, I think he lives out in Perth now, in Australia. He's a top man, and he was a good mucker on that trip. We had a lot of fun.
Was that Zimbabwe tour a good reintroduction to cricket for you? Because of course, Zimbabwe at that time didn't really have any express quicks. Or I'm just wondering, in your own mind, did you feel you had to face bowlers of pace again to prove to yourself and others that you could still do it?
I certainly needed to prove to myself that I could do it, and more importantly, to others, that I could still do it. Not many people knew about my eye issues, to be honest with you. I didn't really broadcast that at the time. You know, I subsequently, you know, told people what the actual situation was. But at the time, I didn't let the world know exactly how much sight that I'd lost. That I think Heath Street was playing out there at the time. He was a young guy, and Heath wasn't a quick bowler, but he was a genuine opening bowler. I got a 50, I think, on that trip, maybe a 60, couple of scores, but nothing mega. But what it did prove to me was I was able to do it. I knew I was able to bat to a level that would probably get me through county cricket.
Did you start to experiment with contact lenses or glasses, or were they of no use at all?
They were no use. The vision was just not there. Never, but I mean, I wear glasses now for reading. That's all.
Did you actually start to wonder if it was the end of your career?
Yes and no. I'd been offered an insurance payout in 1984. At the end of that season, I got insurance for you know, not being able to play. But then there was a career-ending lump sum that was available if I chose not to play again. I mean, you know, it was quite a lot of money. But the fact is, I felt that I was good enough and my eyesight was good enough to be able to play county cricket again. You know, I was only, whatever it was, 28 or 29 at the time. I'd got sort of 6 or 7 years still to play. I was going to benefit, hopefully, in 1990. And obviously, I knew that, you know, captaining Warwickshire was going to be a possibility. So all in all, weighing things up, and that was the right thing to do, I'm sure.
But you knew at that point that that was the end of your England career?
Oh, yeah, 100%. It was never, ever on my mind again. Never, ever on my mind again. I mean, I knew. When you're flawed at top level in sport, you get found out. If a boxer isn't 100% fit for his fight, or Mo Farah isn't in absolutely perfect condition for his races, they get found out. As good as they are, these people, as good as they are, if they're not bang on the day, you get found out. And I would have got found. Well, I was never in a position ever again to contemplate Test match cricket.
Did any players or people help you cope with the situation? These days, of course, there's sports psychologists and all sorts of support for players in this sort of situation. Was anyone able to get around you and help you back on your feet, metaphorically?
Well, Jill, my wife, was a psychologist, actually, sports psychologist. So she was a great support at the time. And it was a little different in those days. You know, you didn't have the backup teams that the lads benefit from today. You know, you had to be very strong-minded, strong-willed, clear-thinking. And, you know, I got good people around me. As I say, you know, Dennis Seamus was still around, and even Bob after he'd retired, and David Brown after he left Warwickshire. They're lifelong friends. They all sort of have their input, but basically it's down to you and your state of mind. And I'm a very positive person generally, and I was able to, you know, deal with it as best I could.
Do you remember the first short ball you faced after your comeback? Had your nerve been affected at all, or was it simply a vision issue?
Yeah, I don't like blowing my own trumpet is a simple phrase, but my first county match back, I think, was against Glamorgan at Edgbaston. And at the time, Glamorgan had a pretty sharp opening bowler called Greg Thomas. And Tomo, he was a good bowler, you know, not stupid, but he bowled a lot of short balls to me. And I got a big score in that innings.
that was your D-Day, if you like. That was the innings that convinced you that, you know what, I can do something here for the rest of my career.
Yeah, and more importantly, I think with it being against Greg was a sharp opening bowler, as I say, and I think it showed people, you know, in my own team as much as anything else, as well as the opposition who were just looking at the results, hey, he can still do it, this kid, you know.
How easy was it to come to terms with the fact that in your own mind you weren't going to play for England again? It had been your Everest, if you like, as it is for any player wanting to play at the highest level. You'd got there and then it had been taken away from you. How easy was it to come to terms with that?
I'm very philosophical about that. You know, had I not been hit on the head, Malcolm might have got me out next ball. I might have got naught in the second innings and still played one test match for England. You know, who knows what would have happened? All we know is what did happen. And you move on in life. I mean, I actually was better known than people that had played half a dozen tests. You know, I couldn't name them. But, you know, I was known as the guy that was hit on the head, unlucky, and never played again. Never dismissed. I know I'm an answer to a Trivial Pursuit question, for example. Probably not the modern version. But you move on. I'm a big believer in fate, and you know, you have to make the most of what you have, and that's always what I've tried to do.
Quite incredibly, given the fact that you lost that 35% of vision in your right eye, you topped 1,000 first class runs in 5 seasons after your comeback. But were you the same player?
No, nothing like. I mean, I was 25% as good, I'd say, maybe more. I played more shots. I didn't play the long game like I'd done previously. I basically was a more attacking player. And I think the things that changed me and drove me forward were the fact that in 1988, I became captain of Warwickshire. And in 1988, my daughter Sophie was born. And, you know, those two things, you know, really take your focus. You don't think about much else. You know, when you're captain of a cricket team, you think about everybody in the team, the squad, how you prepare, how they play, the tactics, the opposition. I mean, you're totally engulfed in that. And then I always lived about half an hour outside of Birmingham. And on my way home, I'd sort of park that and then try and move into family mode. And, you know, that's the way I try to live life after that.
Did you have to make any changes to your game, either technically or mentally? Were you more open-chested, for example, to bring
I understand what you're saying about being a bit more, you know, easing my right shoulder to give me more eyesight. And I did try that. I did try that. And I think, yes, I maybe did try and get my left eye more involved in vision stakes. But, I mean, we're dealing with, you know, minutiae here, really. You know, I think the most important thing is your state of mind and confidence level. And I think as long as you hit the middle of the bat often enough as a batsman, you retain your confidence.
Do you remember the next time you faced Malcolm Marshall? And was there any residual issue for you in doing so?
Yeah, the first game I played against him, I can. This is very funny. All right, it wasn't that funny. It was at Portsmouth. And we're playing Hampshire, of course, and we're in the field on the first day, and I'm at slip to Norman Gifford, who bowls an arm ball to their middle-order batsman, a chap called Kevin James, and he got an edge that flew to slip and hit me straight in the face on my nose, and my nose was split to smithereens, and I was yanked off to hospital. I never faced Malcolm Marshall in that game.
So, well, there was no residual issue about facing him then in that case.
Not in that game, no. And then, we played at Edgbaston after that a couple of times, you know. But he was never, you know, he bowled short balls at me. But like I said before, he was Hampshire's opening bowler. He wasn't the West Indies opening bowler.
How many times have you replayed that ball in your mind over the years since? Have you come to terms with it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it always hits me. But I just, like I say, I take it as fate. You know, I mean, I had a love for got out of the way of it. But like I say, the way I look at it, he might have bowled me out middle stump next ball, got naught in the second innings. You know, so, you know, what route would I have taken then? You know, but if you can't deal with these things in life, if you can't deal with a setback, then you haven't got the character required to get to the top in anything.
Did you look at the runs that were scored by England batsmen in India the winter that followed, 84-5, when England won that series under David Gower, and also the run fest against Australia in 1985, and ever allow yourself to think, do you know what? That could and perhaps should have been me.
Yeah, I did. I know Foxy got millions in India, and I think Chris Broad got man of the series in Australia. And yes, obviously you think, oh, that would have been nice to have played against the Indian attack at that time anyway. Would have been a little different to the West Indian one. But like I say, it's life.
And how do you reflect upon things now? Are you frustrated that one good ball or an error of judgment cost you a potentially long England career? Or are you grateful to be able to say you played for England? Or is it a mix of the two or more besides?
Every kid growing up that's a sports fanatic like I was wants to represent their country. And I was a decent footballer. I could play table tennis, anything with a ball I was good at. I got great ball sense. And I came and played cricket. And to play for England was fantastic. I came from a little village in Shropshire, who are a minor county now, and they were a minor county, even more minor county then. And, you know, it was a fairy tale, you know, from a little village on the Welsh border to representing your country in a test match against one of the best teams cricket's ever seen. And it was it was fantastic. I feel a sense of achievement in that. But again, you know, I also think I've gone on and done a few other good things in life too. You know, my daughter, I'm very proud of. I've got two girls. They went back to Australia with my my wife and I. We split up in the early 2000s, and the girls went to Australia. I obviously FaceTime, and we go to Australia occasionally these days. And Sophie's hopefully going to have a first baby in about a month's time. So that's all very exciting. You know, other things come into your life to take you over.
I was going to say, subsequently, you've had a very varied life and a full life with a sports events company. I think you've had an involvement with a stud farm. You've managed and even caddied for golfers on the European Tour. Where does your cricket career, and especially your England career, sit with you now?
That's obviously the best thing I've ever done, playing cricket. I mean, as I'm sure all people say, representing your country is the ambition, or should be the ambition, of any aspiring young sportsman. And I did that once in a few one-day games, and that was fantastic. But then also, you know, I only ever played for one county, Warwickshire. I became captain. I had a young team that when I moved on from, you know, it became one of the great county teams of the 90s. And, you know, a lot of those, I mean, we've got a WhatsApp group that we still keep in touch today, although Alan Donald and Gladstone and Tim Munton, Roger Tews, you know, Dermot, you know, we all send each other a message every now and then. You know, it was a great time on the county scene as well as England. So cricket gave me an awful lot. The events business was just throwing parties and having fun at the time. And I met a lot of very nice people in the various businesses that I became associated with. And now the stud farm, I've always been interested in horse racing. We're doing great things with the horses right now. And, you know, that's also incredibly enjoyable. But you'd have to say playing for your country is the best thing that any kid can do.
Where's your England kit now, Andy? Your one-day kit and your test kit. It was all whites in those days, but different kits for the one-day side and the test side. And, of course, your cap, which you never got the chance to wear on the field.
I've still got the cap, and I've got the blazer, and I've got the tie. The helmet, I think, is in the Warwickshire Museum, or it's certainly up there somewhere. Probably, you know, something else has taken it over. And the kit, I've still got the kits upstairs, I think. Yeah, it's in the attic somewhere. Family heirloom.
When I say to you, Andy Lloyd, cap 505, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, you know, at the time, you don't really... When all the numbering came in, it didn't really quite register. I've got a golf ball here that's got 505 on one side and 74 on the other, because I was the 74th person to play one-day cricket for England. And I got some golf balls printed, you know, with those two numbers on. And I've only got a few left now. But when you consider when cricket, Test cricket first began, only 504 people had played for your country before you. That, I think, that's when you really realise you've achieved something. Only 504 people had played for England prior to me lining up at Edgerton that day.
Andy Lloyd, you can be extremely proud of everything you achieved in the game, and particularly representing England as the 505th Test player. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for making the time, and it really is appreciated.
My pleasure, Brian. It's been fun thinking about it.
So that was Andy's story. I found it incredibly uplifting as, despite the fact his dreams of a long career with England were snuffed out after just 30 minutes, he still managed to maintain such a positive outlook on his career and his life in general. Andy's can-do attitude allowed him to keep playing successfully for Warwickshire, even though the carrot of another England call-up was beyond him. And the work he and coach Bob Woolmer did at the back end of his career laid the groundwork for a golden era for the county after he'd retired. I hope you'll agree, Andy's story is a fantastic one, and I'm delighted we had the chance to chat and to share it with you. So that's another tale from One Test Wonder, and there's more where that came from. And as ever, please subscribe, like, and let others know all about this podcast if you can. And if you've got any feedback or comments, you can always email mergersb@gmail.com. That's mergersb@gmail.com. Until next time, this is Brian Murgatroyd. Thanks very much for listening.